Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
Hello and welcome to Mormon Stories. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and this is another episode in our mental health relational series. And today with me I have Sarah, mother of four, here to talk to me about postpartum depression. She is a lifelong member of the church and has struggled with depression since adolescence, and is here to speak with us today about her experiences specifically with postpartum depression. And before we get started, I'd just like to make a few precluding comments as far as our goals for this podcast tonight. One is basically just to share a story and to share an experience and hopefully reach out to other women who have dealt with similar topics. By no means are we going to be all inclusive, and by no means is Sarah's experience going to resonate with everyone who's had postpartum depression. Some people have postpartum depression only as part of giving birth without any history of depression in their past. Some have a history of depression in their past and then also struggle with postpartum depression. And there's lots of different ways and reasons and et cetera that all of this can develop. The second thing I want to say is that this is not a podcast that's going to touch on her testimony or issues surrounding, kind of her relationship with the church, other than we will be speaking briefly about how her beliefs and, construct around church issues has affected some of her ways that she dealt with her depression or thought about her depression in during her journey. With that being said, I want to welcome Sarah. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. I really appreciate it. I think that this is a very important topic to be discussing, and I'm just very glad you're willing to do this for us. So I'd like to start with a little bit of just your background, and specifically give us your background regarding when you felt like you started noticing that depression was a part of your life, and maybe some family history around that or et cetera.
Well, basic background that as a listener to Mormon Stories one might find interesting would be I am a lifelong member of the church. I grew up in the church. Both my parents were born and raised in the church. Both sets of their parents were born and raised in the church. All the sets of great-grandparents were born and raised in the church.
Multi-generational.
Multi-generational. Lots of Mormons crossing the plains. And I'm the oldest of a lot of kids in my family, actually six.
But no antidepressants as they were crossing the plains, right? Is that
not that are recorded, not that we have found a history of, no. But thank you for asking.
Okay.
And is the oldest in my family, probably have a little bit of that overachieving anal thing going on as a teenager. And my junior year of high school, I can remember very specifically because I was getting straight A's and had always gotten straight A's up to that point. And there were some pressures, and there was kind of a straw that broke the camel's back, and a boyfriend broke up with me. And all of a sudden, I just didn't care about anything. I was sleeping every afternoon when I came home. My grades dropped dramatically. They went from straight A's to straight D's at a progress report. And
over the time of what time frame are we looking at? A few weeks, a few months?
Over the course of about a month or so. I gained about 10 pounds in 2 weeks. Pretty drastic. And I didn't really talk to my parents a lot about it. I didn't tell them, oh, by the way, my grades are D's right now. There was a teacher who pulled me into her office and asked if I was on drugs. And it was so laughable to me and so absurd, because I did have a reputation as a good Mormon girl, that I could only sputter, no, I would never, no. And I felt like I could see the wheels turning in her mind. Denial is the first stage. And she asked some of my other teachers in the school, do you think that she is on drugs?
Wow.
And And they said, no, you've got the wrong girl. She doesn't do stuff like that. I remember turning in an essay for a history class that I was supposed to write something about U.S. history. And I talked about how nothing mattered at all in life. Some very dark journal entries. And anyway, it was a weird period. It lasted a total of about 4 months. And then I kind of bounced back. And I really just thought I was a freak.
That you had just had a weird experience, or did you tally it up to the whole boyfriend breakup?
You know, kind of the boyfriend breakup, kind of I didn't know, more of just there must be something really wrong with me.
Did your parents ever pick up on this 4 month streak? Did they show concern?
You know, I'm sure they did, but there again, I was the oldest. There were 5 kids at home at the time. They were dealing with a lot of things, and I think they probably chalked it up to a teenage girl having hormonal things. You know, I was their oldest, and so they hadn't experienced exactly what teenagers did, but they knew it was a very volatile time emotionally and hormonally, and I think they just kind of chalked it up to that.
Did you find yourself becoming like the typical lippy kind of attitude type teenager?
Very
this
sassy.
Time? Or
yeah,
did you
extremely.
Withdraw and become quiet and sad? And
I was lippy to my parents, but yeah, a lot of time spent in my bedroom crying, a lot of Depeche Mode, that place is my age, but yeah, it was the 80s. a lot of morose music and, you know.
Okay. And did you, as far as, at that point, there was no outer help then that was sought at. There was no, you didn't go to a psychologist or.
No. And, you know, when I bounced back and my grades came back up and, you know, off and on, I felt a little bit weird, but I didn't. Yeah. I mean, I just chalked it up to, I was a loser and, you know, and there had been something really wrong with me and it seemed fixed to a degree. And then, so that was my junior year, the spring of my junior year. And then the summer after my senior year of high school, so not quite a year and a half later, I remember reading, I don't even know what kind of magazine it was, probably Women's Health or I don't know. It was something my mom had laying around the house. And there was a checklist in it talking about symptoms of a major depressive thing. And I was going down thinking back to my junior year, and every single one, except for the weight loss because I had gained weight, and except for the abusing drugs and alcohol because I had never tried those, I fit every single one.
Did that include suicidal thoughts? And
yeah, I had. In fact, I... not suicide as in, oh, I had a plan and I wanted to, you know, it wasn't that, but I do remember walking home one day on a busy street and thinking, wow, it'd be so easy to just step in front of a car. Mm-hmm. And immediately when I had that thought, I thought, oh my goodness, that's so wrong. I can't believe I thought that, but it did cross my mind. So there wasn't a plan. It wasn't, you know, but there were mostly, it was a just feelings of, at that time, it had been, I hate myself. I hate myself. I mean, just this true self-loathing.
And so affecting, obviously, your self-esteem. And
you're
saying you classified yourself as a loser. Did you continue to classify yourself as a loser after the episode had happened?
No. I mean, to a degree, I had a really great set of friends. I didn't confide in them what was going on internally, but I had really supportive friends, and I did a lot with them. And so I think that masked a lot of it. And plus, I think I was just really good at masking some things, and I did feel better. But like I said, reading this article, I thought, oh my goodness, that's what that was. It wasn't the
label.
I could put a label to it. Oh my goodness, that was depression. That's what that was. Mm-hmm.
So. Did that help with some of those feelings, having that label? Like, oh, I wasn't totally crazy. Or I wasn't
it did.
A loser.
It did. And I think the most remarkable thing was just feeling, oh, I'm so glad I don't feel that way now. Mm. that was the most remarkable thing, is not having those feelings that year and a half later.
Okay. Did you, before having children, did you have any other depressive episode other than that one during your high school years?
That's the one that stands out to me the most. I attended college at BYU. I earned my undergraduate degree there, and I also
in Provo,
and I served a mission in Latin America. And during those times, I would say there were maybe periods of a couple months where, it never got that bleak per se, but I knew this is depression. This is, you know, just the sleeping more, the little easily more irritated, the loss of interest in things that I like to do, the feeling of, oh, things don't really matter, that, you know, and it was never quite as drawn out. But it would be for a period of, you know, a month, 2 months, usually about 2 months. And I would say that happened probably once on my mission, maybe once before my mission, and maybe once after, during the college years.
And you were able to then, by then, recognize it for what it was and just
right.
kind of know what you were in for. And
yeah, and so just, you know, okay, what's on my plate? What can I take off of that so that I can kind of focus on me and do some self-healing? And it usually cleared up. I didn't go to a doctor about it. I did talk with my mom about it later at that point, and that was when I found out that after the birth of her fifth child, she had gone through a major postpartum depression, which she didn't even know what it was as it was starting out, and then later learned about that. So,
okay. And before that, she had not had any issues with depression, as far as you know?
No. Uh-uh.
Okay. And do you know of any history in your family other than your mother that has struggled with depression or?
Yeah, there is actually. And it seems to, you know, I don't, as I'm trying to think of how to best word or to best articulate it, it seems to mostly follow the female line. And I don't know if that's because it hasn't affected the men or, you know, coming from a large Mormon, just a whole bunch of people that are Mormon, cousins, aunts, uncles, everybody. You know, sometimes with mental illness, you see a lot of the addictions, and I haven't seen that quite as much only because they're substances that nobody ever tried. You know, a lot of people in my family never tried alcohol or never tried drugs. And so they didn't have that. But, you know, certainly I've seen food addictions, and I know that there are several women, aunts, cousins, et cetera, that have had problems with that.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point you bring up, because I think for the numbers just in general around depression show that women do suffer from depression more than men. But there is some question right now as to, is that just because women are talking about it more than men
right.
do? Or, you know, are we, I guess, diagnosing that correctly in the mental health field?
Yeah.
Or are men exhibiting different symptoms than women do with depression?
Yeah.
Sometimes like overworking or, you know, kind of escaping in other ways that we don't always classify as depressive
yeah.
symptoms. So anyway, that's an interesting point. Okay. So you have some family history with depression. Your mother shares with you that she's had an experience with postpartum depression.
And that was during, it must've been at some point during college, because I remember prior to my mission. So prior to being 21, we had talked about it because I remember, I don't remember the exact conversation per se, but I know that we had had several discussions about it at that point.
Okay.
So.
And then so you graduate from BYU, is that, mm-hmm. and what did you graduate in? What was your field of study?
I graduated in English.
Okay.
And so, you know, the job market is just thrilled to accept bachelor's in English when... Oh, wait, no, not so much. Yeah, so you can do administrative assistant or flip burgers, you know, kind of equally with your peers that did not go to college. And so I worked as an administrative assistant for several years, got married a couple of years after college, and then have not worked, just from moving around, living in different states, have not worked outside the home since the birth of our first child. And that was 11 years ago.
Okay. And you have 4 children.
4.
Mm-hmm. And did your husband, when you met your husband and got married, was this even part of the conversation, the fact that you'd had some episodes with depression?
You know, it probably should have been. And this is really embarrassing to recall now. But, you know, in our 20s, hopefully I've grown up since then. I don't know. But as a 25-year-old, I thought, oh, my goodness, I better tell him, because what if he wants to back out? And I never told him.
And because you were afraid that he would back out?
No, not that I was afraid that he was back out, but just more like I didn't want him to feel like I was withholding information mm-hmm. that he would have liked to have known. Mm-hmm. And so if I recall correctly, and if he were here, maybe he could correct me on this. I don't think I told him till a couple nights before we got married. And I said, there's something I need to tell you, which thinking back on it now, I wonder if his heart was racing. I mean, you know, here we are, these two sweet little Mormon kids. anyway, and I mentioned depression, that I had had it before, that it was something that, you know, I hadn't had a major episode since high school, but it was something that I was in, you know, I dabbled here and there, and I make it sound like art or something, right, but,
you were in remission from.
Yeah. And you know, he was really excited about the wedding. He was like, oh yeah, that's great. I mean,
it didn't faze him.
No.
Was it anxiety producing to tell him or to come up with the words to know how to communicate that to him or?
Well, it must've been if I didn't tell him till several nights before. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, looking back on it, it wasn't like, for months, I thought, I have to tell him, but I can't, but I have to, but I wasn't really thinking about it.
Right.
And yeah, cause it was a strange turn of events to the engagement and that, but anyway, but that's, you know, sent for different Mormon stories.
Okay. I suppose. Okay. So then you go into your marriage pretty aware that depression is part of your history. Your husband knows about it at some level. And you, at some point, have your first child. How many years go by before you...
We had been married for a little over 2 years.
Okay.
When our oldest was born. And honestly, having talked with my mom and having gone through depressive periods before, I fully expected that I would go through postpartum depression. And I don't know if anyone can ever really be prepared for that, but it was something that I was aware of. And I remember my OBGYN telling me, you need to look for these certain signs. And was I overwhelmed? Yeah. What brand new mom of any baby is not overwhelmed? But, and I would cry, but it, you know, it didn't even really feel like baby blues. I knew what depression felt like, and it didn't feel a thing like that. And I thought, fantastic. Mm-hmm. I don't get postpartum depression. This is wonderful. Mm-hmm. It can has eluded me.
Yeah. Can you elaborate a little bit on how it was different? Because some, like you said, some women maybe haven't had the experience with depression to be able to, you know, compare the two. So what was different about it?
Well, for me, during the periods where I felt like I had been more depressed, I guess one doesn't necessarily go in and out of depression. You either have it or you don't. But there's times for me that have been more overwhelming. And during those parts, similar to when I had been in high school, but not matching exactly because I wasn't 16 anymore, there was always some form of self-loathing and just, oh, I'm so annoyed with myself. I can't do anything right. I'm so dumb. I'm so stupid. I'm so fat, which I look back at pictures now and thought, I was never fat, but you know, I mean, just the thinking is distorted,
right.
You know, what are other people thinking of me? And just, for me, I was always sleeping a lot more. I love to talk to people. I love to talk on the phone, and typically I wouldn't care to do that as often mm-hmm. when I was depressed. Now, having said that, I don't know that my friends or roommates knew because I didn't confide in them that I did. And
you were able to mask it enough.
Yeah, I was able to mask it enough. And it was never something like, oh, when I'm depressed, I don't do this. I mean, I could still function, but for me, it always felt like kind of a bare minimal level. and you know, the weepy, the sad, the everything sad, everything's hard. And you know, I think that's why sometimes it's hard to tell, well, is this postpartum depression or just having a new baby? Because
having a new baby is
hard.
Yeah. So what would you classify what you felt were normal feelings of, like, basic baby blues that wouldn't qualify as postpartum depression?
Well, for me, I would always kind of go back to, what I had read in articles or in books which was, are these symptoms lasting? Are they daily for a period of 2 weeks or longer? Mm-hmm. And for me, after the birth of my first child, it wasn't. It would be 2 days of sadness followed by 3 weeks of, yeah, this is tough, but we're going to get through it, you know, and then I'd have another bad day, but it wasn't every single day was hard and I couldn't get out of it. And so for me, having known before, okay, if it's 2 weeks or more, and that was just something I'd read. I clearly am not a medical professional by any stretch of the imagination.
No, right. I think that's great that you had that information to help you sort through.
And that was really kind of my benchmark. Okay, how long has it gone on? And, you know, and I never even got after the birth of our first child, I never even got to the 4 or 5 day mark.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have your first child. You do not have postpartum depression. You're like, woo-hoo, hooray.
Yeah.
This is not going to be a problem for me. 2 years later?
18 months later.
It
could have been part
later.
Of the problem.
Okay. 18 months later, you have your second child.
Yes. And, you know, and I was fine. I remember going into my 6 week checkup and talking, with the,
so at the very beginning of your pregnancy, not 6 week or 6 week.
No, I'm sorry. This is the 6 week postpartum checkup.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. So this is my 6 week checkup, 6 weeks after I've delivered, and talking with it was a nurse midwife I was talking to at that appointment, and she was screening me for some signs. And I mean, I was really tired, but I knew that was very normal to be very tired. And pardon me, I was exhausted, but we had had family come into town. I had had friends. Everything was had kind of been a whirlwind.
Sure.
For 6 weeks. And I had spent some time home with the kids, but we were living several states away, from any family at all. So there wasn't family that could come in and help. My parents were actually serving a mission at the time. And so my mom was not able to, you know, sometimes moms come and stay in the home, and she has with subsequent births, but she was not able to come and do that. And, anyway, so the first 6 weeks, I was paying more attention, just kind of getting through every day.
Sure.
So when I got to that checkup and they're screening me for depression, no, I'm fine. Yeah, we're doing great. And I wasn't really showing any of, I think, what I would consider classic signs of depression. You know, do you have the loss of interest? Do you have your sleeping patterns changed? Have your eating patterns changed? Have your thought processes changed? Have your relationship changed? You know, things that I tend to think of as classic markers.
Right.
I wasn't seeing.
Right.
So, and then it was after that first 6 weeks, that I just really felt like I couldn't get it together. And the babies were close. I thought I had a baby and a big girl, but looking back now, that is completely and totally ridiculous. I had two babies. And, you know, and everybody said, oh, it is. It's harder with the second. And when, you know, when she's 6 months old, when your baby's 6 months old, everything's going to be so much better. And so in my mind, I really kind of thought, okay, let's slog through this first 6 months. And I mean, I really kind of expected that I would wake up to sunshine and roses on 6 months to the day.
Right.
And my life would go back to, I would feel normal.
So this is 4 months then that you're slogging through.
At least. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah.
Can you talk about that? What was that like?
It was dark. I mean, it was kind of a mess. And then it got darker after that, but it was... I was tired, you know, and a lot of it is just new motherhood. The house was a mess. I was tired. I felt like I wasn't doing everything that I wanted to be able to do. And, you know, hindsight says, well, yeah, you can do those things. You maybe just can't do them right after you have a baby. Mm-hmm. and that's okay. But just very overwhelmed and feeling frustrated that I was overwhelmed. I'm staying home, for goodness sakes. It's not like I'm going out and working and getting paid to work and then coming home and trying to do it. You know, I'm here. Why can't I get it done? And I wish I could have brought it with me this evening, but in the organizational chaos, no, there's no organization in my home. I couldn't find the journal that is quasi-representational of that period. I'm not a very good journal keeper. But there were so many entries that said, you know, I'm really sick of this. I'm really tired. I this wasn't what I was expecting. And so but I know that if I would eat better and get some exercise and pray more fervently and read my scriptures, that things would turn around. So these are my goals for the next month and I'm going to do it. And then mm-hmm. I'd write a month later. Okay, this time I really mean it, not like last time. And then a month later, I can't believe I'm writing this again because I thought I meant it last time, but this time I'm really committed. You know, months of, and then, you know, just so garbage. Blaming. I'm a failure as a mother. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
A lot of that self-blame. Like if I was doing certain things, this wouldn't be happening to me. If I right. was able to,
yeah.
you know, check the checklist off, I would right. be, you know, somehow this would go away. This is all my fault per se.
Yeah. And then magically or unmagically at 6 months when things didn't change, I thought, okay, maybe this isn't just having the second baby. mm-hmm. Maybe this, cause part of me thought, well, maybe this is normal. Maybe this is how everybody feels. And so then at 6 months it became, okay, well, I can't keep operating this way. No, I'll go ahead and fast forward and say I did not seek any kind of treatment until she was a year old. Okay. And so then it was another 6 months of,
was it the second 6 months of making these checklists for yourself? Is that?
It was, but it was worse because the first 6 months it was almost kind of like, oh, well, no one expects me to be able to do anything. Therefore, I don't need to have expectations of myself because I don't know why I had that magic 6 month thing in my head. I mean, mm-hmm. one woman said that to me. So all yeah. of a sudden it's true for every woman. I don't know. I mean, it's, yeah, in hindsight, it's dumb, but.
Where was your husband in all this as far as?
He was working full time. Mm-hmm. Like I said, we lived several states away from upper Midwest. So we lived several states away from any other family, but I had a good, you know, pretty good support group of friends. I didn't tell them what I was going through. And so he worked full time. He had a calling in the church. We went to church every Sunday and he was supportive, but I think because I kept telling him, I need to stop eating sugar and I need to exercise 3 to 4 times a week. And he'd say, yeah, I support you. And that sounds great. I think because I was thinking I could quote, snap out of it. Mm-hmm. He kept thinking, okay, she says she can. Great. Let's move on that.
Right. Did he ever express concern? Like, did he notice that you weren't doing well or was it more just what you were reporting to him?
Probably more what I was reporting to him. I mean, certainly he would see it. It's kind of hard not to notice when you come home at 5:30 and your wife still has not showered and every day is pajama jammy jam. Yeah, so I'm sure he did. And, you know, I would say, I think I finally started talking to my mom about it on the phone. And I don't remember exactly, but it might have been around the 9-10 month mark. And I remember that one thing that my parents did, which in hindsight, I thought was really cool of them, really amazing, is they called my husband. I mean, specifically called him and both touched him and said, look, this is a serious thing. This is not going to go away. Mm-hmm. This is not nutrition, exercise. This is serious stuff. And my mom talked to him and my dad did too, mm-hmm. because my dad's never suffered from depression from a day in his life. He does not, right. It doesn't come from his side of the family.
Right.
And so I thought that was really, so
So sharing kind of what his experience had been with your mother and
I would assume so. Yeah. I wasn't in on the conversation, but just, you know, this is something that you guys really can't solve on your own. And so she needs help. And as much as you can support her in getting that help outside of the family, that would probably in your best interest. You know, they weren't telling him what you need to do. And they certainly weren't. It was more of, you know, she is telling you this, but we are telling you is probably bigger than what she's admitting to.
Well, I'm noticing a common theme too, that, you know, you say from high school on, it was difficult for you to confide in people when you were going through the depressive states. In other words, your friends usually didn't know.
Right. Your I felt stupid. And even though I knew it was a real disorder, I hope this story is okay, but this is Mormon Stories after all. But I remember being 19 and sitting in a singles ward at BYU, and I have no idea what the Relief Society lesson was about that day. But sitting in a Relief Society lesson, somehow the topic in conversation and sharing turned to depression. And I remember one of the counselors in the bishopric who was sitting in on the lesson, raised his hand and said to the effect, you know, I noticed, he was a good old boy, and I noticed that there's a lot of talk of this depression, and you used to never hear about that. Women would just get up and do it. And I think if people would just stop feeling so sorry for themselves, that we wouldn't hear about this. I just think you need to talk yourself out of it. And I remember even at the time thinking, oh no.
Yeah.
I bet there are girls in this room that think he's right and he's wrong.
Yeah.
This is a very real thing. And I remember being worried because, you know, at 19, I didn't have the confidence to say, well, actually, it's a medical condition and you're totally wrong, you know?
Wow. That's really interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, but I knew that, yes, it happened in the framework of the church. Did I think even at the time it was representational of what men in the church thought? No. But I knew that it was representational of people who either had not struggled with depression or who had personally or had seen it secondhand, perhaps in a family. You know, I knew that that probably was. And so it just sounded kind of dumb. I felt like there was a big stigma attached. I have depression. I have mental illness. It felt like a big hurdle for me to admit to. I felt kind of stupid. Maybe part of me did think, oh, well, maybe I can get to a point that it would totally go away. I don't really know.
Well, you're talking a lot about, a lot of social stigmas, I think. And some of them are just, I think, in the overall culture at large.
Yes.
And then some of it also is our Mormon culture that gets tied in with that. It's right. Hard to kind of separate those things at times.
Yeah.
But it is this kind of common theme that you see people snap out of it. I think you mentioned that already.
Yeah.
Get over it. Don't wallow in it.
Right.
Why can't you just kind of forget it and move on?
Yeah, just think happy thoughts and stop being sad. Just choose to be happy, you know? And I remember thinking, that's got to be the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. Oh, okay, I'll choose to have my diabetes go away and think happy thoughts and wah, it'll go away. You wouldn't do it with cancer or diabetes.
Yeah.
So why would you do that with depression? I don't know.
Well, maybe implying along with that, that you're somehow choosing to be sad.
Right. Yeah, because that's what everybody wants. Sorry about sarcasm there.
No, I think that's part of it, though, that somehow if you're not choosing to be happy, you're choosing to be sad. And
yeah,
there's definitely a stigma, I think, associated with that. So, well, I think it's fabulous that at such an early age, you were able to understand this condition and, you know, kind of at least, like you said, have a label for it.
Yeah. And I don't know that I understood it so much, but there was, there was some knowledge associated with it, and it helped that I could talk to my mom about it when I needed to.
Right.
Yeah.
And that she had a similar experience to be able to relate with.
Right.
Because a lot of people don't have a mom or a dad who can relate with it.
Yeah. And that was immeasurably helpful because she even told me, which I may have said earlier, but when I was expecting our first child, you know, be very aware, make sure to watch for this, mm-hmm. you know, so.
Okay. So getting back on track with where we were kind of in your timeline, you go almost the first full year of your second child's existence. And kind of this very dark or kind of funk place.
Yeah. And, one thing that I love to do is read, and I'm fairly eclectic, although I'm definitely partial to fiction. Not even have to be great fiction. I just like to read. I'll read a cereal box. I'll read a newspaper. I just like to have something in front of me to read. Sure. Tough for me to fall asleep at night if I haven't read. And, as it was getting closer to about the year mark, I noticed that I didn't want to read. And I don't think that had happened to me since I had learned how to read.
Wow.
And
there's something you love dearly that you connect with.
And the other thing is, I was just so convinced, and it's painful to think about now. I wish I could find this journal that I had referred to, because I read the journal entries that woman, who was me, wrote, and I still weep for her. Because it was just such a dark place. But I remember thinking, I am such a horrible mom. My girls, they were both girls. I can't raise them. And my husband doesn't deserve this. They need another woman, someone who is not me, because I'm never going to be good enough. I'm never going to be able to do this. And so I really, truly thought, that it would be better if I were not around. And by not around, I didn't mean running off of me starting a new life, because I didn't feel like my life was worth living. So was I suicidal in the fact that I didn't want to live? Yes. Did I have a plan? No, because I knew if I offed myself, my husband wouldn't get the life insurance. Oh. And that would put him in a big financial bind.
Right.
I really thought they would do better with another mother and he would do better with another wife. And I just did not want to live. And that was really difficult too, because that is very at odds with, you know, with what the church teaches. We're not supposed to have thoughts like that. And so it was awful. And I would.
So add on the guilt.
Yeah. So the guilt too. And and it was daily that I felt this way. And so I kept saying, okay, well, I will try that back to my goals. I will do this for 2 months. And if I don't feel better in 2 months after exercising and eating more fruits and vegetables and not eating so much sugar and reading my scriptures every day and praying more fervently, if in 2 months things haven't changed, then I will go see a doctor. And by doctor, I meant I would go to a psychiatrist. But in my mind, I thought, well, what's a psychiatrist going to do? They're just going to tell me to go on medication, and I'm nursing a baby, so I can't go on medication. And, you know, I just, for me, if I could go back to myself as two different people, me now and and me in the early, you know, in 2001, 2002, and just shake myself by the shoulders, maybe slap myself around for a minute and be like, you idiot. Your baby will be fine. Go on medication, stop nursing the baby, and get your life back. Yeah. Because I wasn't mothering her very well. I wasn't being a good wife. I wasn't doing anything particularly well, because I wasn't doing anything at all.
Right. You weren't able to even care for yourself, really.
No. Which... I mean, it's, you know, I didn't never shower. I just didn't frequently shower.
Right.
I didn't never do laundry. I just didn't frequently do laundry. Yeah. So, we were functioning at a bare minimal level.
Well, did you find that you know, these checklists that you would come up with, would you do those things? Or was it that you were
A good 17 hours, yeah.
Because that's part of the thing, you know, is a lot of people will come up with those kinds of suggestions, right?
Yeah.
For if you just do this, if you just do that, and especially in church, you know, a lot of the spiritual suggestions, like reading scriptures or praying,
which are good, which are really good,
which are great things. But if you're in a bout of severe depression, your motivation,
I couldn't, and it wasn't even that I wasn't motivated. I wanted to. I just couldn't. And which sounds really stupid. I mean, like literally stupid if you haven't gone through depression. Well, what do you mean you can't? Just decide that you can. But you can't. It's not that you don't want to get out of the bed. You can't get out of the bed.
Right.
And even saying it, it still sounds dumb.
Yeah.
What do you mean you can't? But you can't. And so I would make the list, get through it for 17 hours. The next day would be a bomb. Well, I'll do better tomorrow. Okay, I didn't do it. Well, I'll do better tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. For real tomorrow. I mean it this time. And then you just kind of give up because it's not going anywhere anyway.
And plus now, again, back to the theme of guilt and shame. You're feeling worse about yourself. If I could only get myself together.
And even my closest friends, I remember months afterward, once I had finally started taking medication, and my friends saying, wait, you were depressed? And we talked every week and saw each other every week, but I think it can be something that's typical of postpartum depression is you just withdraw so far into yourself. Yeah. And I certainly did just, I mean, I was going to say it's a selfish disease. I'm kind of choking over my words, and it's not, because I think selfish kind of implies a choice. And I didn't really feel like I had a choice because I would have chosen to not be depressed and chosen to care for my family and do that. But I was just so drawn into me and right. focused on me and what I couldn't do.
Right. Interesting. Well, so going back then to talk us through how you finally made that transition from, you know, I can't be on meds. I'm nursing my baby. That's not for me. I'm going to do these checklists. To finally taking that step to get more professional help?
Well, I had talked to my husband several months before we hit that 1 year mark and said, you know, I might want to go see a doctor. Well, why do you want to go see a doctor? Well, this is really bad. The depression's really bad. Well, what do you think a doctor will say? Well, I think the doctor will tell me that I need to go on antidepressants. Oh, but you're nursing. I thought you wanted to nurse. Well, I do want to nurse. And he wasn't saying, you have to nurse, you promise it. He wasn't saying that. He was genuinely trying to understand, which I realize as I'm saying it can sound not that way, but I'm telling you, the proper interpretation would be he really was saying, oh, but you had said that you wanted to do this. And that was a concern of mine. Oh, but nursing's so healthy for the baby. Well, it sure is, but it's not healthy for the baby to have a suicidal mother. Mm-hmm. And so we need to treat that. And he said, yeah, if you need to do that. And so finally, I remember laying in bed one night and with him, and just kind of laying it out on the line. The problem is, I don't want to be alive. I don't want to be here. I love you, and I love you so much that I think you would be better off without me, with another woman or someone, and I don't want to be away from you. I just don't want to be here on earth at all. I don't want this body. I don't want this brain. I don't want it. And he said, I had no idea it was that bad. He said, I really think you need to make that appointment with the doctor. Yeah. And I said, yeah, that's what I'm telling you. I need to make the appointment with the doctor. I made an appointment with a psychiatrist.
Let me just stop right there because yeah. a lot of people would either go to their OBGYN or to their primary health, physician. What made you go directly to the psychiatrist, which is more the specialist in this, which I think was a great idea, but yeah. what
didn't have a primary care physician.
Okay.
And did not particularly care for my OB.
Okay.
And also, I referred quite a while back to the 6 week postpartum checkup I had had where I was doing fine. I mean, I felt great. And, the nurse midwife she was a certified nurse midwife who worked in conjunction with my OBGYN. In his office and she had mentioned, okay, if you do have some problems, you can come back to us. You can also go to a psychiatrist.
Okay. So she had made that recommendation.
And so I just basically went to, you know, the provider directory. Who does my insurance cover? Who lives close by? Because I'm still nursing this baby and I can't be gone all day. Right. And it, we were living in a pretty major, pardon me, metropolitan area. And
okay. No, I think that's a really good suggestion, because especially with the complications of nursing and having small children and all that, a psychiatrist is probably going to have just more information or up-to-date, you know, expertise on.
Yeah. And I felt comfortable with that. And also in talking with my mom, I mean, I can't remember her specifically suggesting go to a psychiatrist, but knowing, you know, that in the extended family, the people had gone to psychiatrists before, to me, it didn't seem like, oh, no, I can't go. And that seemed easier than trying to come up with a primary care physician on the spot.
Sure.
And right. getting them to do that. So,
and there's a lot of different names out there. And I know there's some confusion, at least that I come across. So just to make it clear, a psychiatrist is a doctor, an MD, who has then gone on to specialize in his or her residency program in the brain and psychiatry.
Yeah.
So that's, and you know, so obviously they can prescribe medication and all that. Okay, so why don't you walk us through then what that first meeting was like and what he or she recommended? And
you know, honestly, she was kind of surprised, because I was coming to her telling her I have raging postpartum depression and we need to fix that.
Okay.
And
she didn't have to diagnose you.
Yeah, she didn't, really, she didn't really have to diagnose. Oh, well, now what do you mean by this? And you know, I, how long have these symptoms lasted? You know, and so I just kind of ran through, well, this is happening, you know, I'm, you know, my sleeping patterns have changed and everything's a mess, you know. Anyway, I think she was just kind of surprised that I...
You were that self-aware. You
about. Right. And I told her, I said, I don't know, I am nursing. I said, I don't know if I'm totally comfortable going on medication. I just want to see. So I hadn't gone, I had gone to the appointment assuming I probably would come away with a prescription for an antidepressant, but not knowing for sure. And when she found out that my baby was 11 and a half months old, she said, yes, you are done nursing. You will wean the baby in the next 7 days and you will start in 7 days on this antidepressant.
Okay.
And so I did. I weaned her in, it took me 7.5 days, not seven. And, yeah. And I started the antidepressant. And even when I did that, in my mind, I was thinking, okay, this is just to get my toe in the water. This is to kind of kickstart so that I can... I sound so organized when I talk about these checklists. I'm really not. I would hate to set myself up as someone like that, but I like to make lists. Don't always follow them. You know, the follow through is not great, but the anticipation's high. But I thought, yeah, once I have this, then I will be able to, well, because it'll help my brain and I won't feel like such a loser and I won't feel like I wish a bus could hit me and everyone would sob, but everyone would be better off. And that was the weird thing. I look back and of course it doesn't make sense that my family would be better off without me, but I felt that and it made sense, even though it didn't.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, which it doesn't. Sorry.
No, yeah. A lot of that confusion and
that's
definitely
part. But anyway, but in my mind, it was the antidepressants would be short term. Mm-hmm. So I would go on them, make sure I was okay, ultimately try to wean myself and just get back to my regularly scheduled
antidepressant
life. I still felt quite a stigma about that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was, I knew from having seen relatives and seen friends. I mean, not my mom. My mom had gotten really lucky/blessed, and the first antidepressant that she ever tried back in the 80s worked, and she never had to switch. But I knew from other relatives and from other friends that it could be quite what I thought of as a medication roulette. You would try something, it might treat some symptoms, it might make other things worse, and then you try again, and then you try again. And I had been very hesitant to play what I thought of as medication roulette and try something and have it work, and then try something else. And
that is one of the challenges with antidepressants.
And it is hard, because depression is not a one-size-fits-all. Just like I would imagine that listeners who have had postpartum depression could be listening and saying, who does she think she is? That's not even what it is. Mm-hmm. It's not a one-size-fits-all disease, much as cancer is not a one-size-fits-all. The same treatment for one cancer, even if it's in the same family, doesn't work for every patient. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it is a process of figuring out what works. I got really lucky, and the first one I tried worked.
Are you comfortable sharing what that was?
Yeah, it was Celexa. Yeah, and we started on the lowest dose, knowing that we could move up, and, you know, it worked.
At the lowest dose,
it yeah.
worked. Okay. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that a lot of people find discouraging about antidepressants when they've tried it once. I mean, here you are. Imagine being depressed, being all these symptoms that you've talked about. You take this antidepressant. You usually have to wait 2 weeks for it to have an effect. So you're kind of trudging through those 2 weeks. It doesn't work to get back to the doctor, to get back on something else. It tries out. That's a lot of, energy expended.
Well, it is. And I think particularly with postpartum, because I had a friend in the ward. We were not particularly close before I started going through this, but I had mentioned something about depression, and her eyes lit up as much as they could, because she was going through it. Our babies were about 6 months apart.
Okay.
And she was going through that and had not tried medication yet either. And just knowing that someone else was trying it kind of gave her the motivation to do it. And it was really hard. I watched her go through 9 months of trying probably 4 or 5 different medications. And I think that's what's hard when you have postpartum as well, is because you've got this baby and perhaps other kids, but it definitely a baby if it's postpartum with you. And so, you know, you might be trying to work full time, you might be staying home full time, but you've got all these other things. And so you can't just drop everything and arrange a babysitter. And then if you do have to arrange a babysitter, what are you going to say? Oh, I have a doctor appointment. Oh, you do? What's your doctor appointment for? Oh, because I'm a total freak show in my head and need crazy meds. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's hard.
So you talk about that stigma, and that even for you going on an antidepressant was difficult in the sense of feeling like you needed that or somehow.
Well, I had gotten so low and I had let myself get so bad that I was willing to try anything.
Yeah.
But it took me months to get to the point where I was okay with that, because I kept thinking, I don't need medication. I can do it on my own. And, you know, again, I wish I could just take that poor broken girl who was me and say, it's okay. Try it. If it doesn't work, the worst that can happen is you'll still be depressed, but it might get a lot better.
Right.
But yeah, it was really hard. That's why I waited a year. And I certainly would not recommend that. I would recommend that if it's been 2 weeks, go talk to someone.
Right.
Don't wait.
Don't put yourself through that. Well, going back to cultural aspects, I think that whole I can do it on my own comes, again, from our outer American culture. We're very independent people. And then on top of that, the whole pioneer Mormon culture.
You got the pioneer heritage. I mean, they're pushing hand carts in the snow, really? Yeah. I can't.
There's a lot of self-reliance and, you know, as far as a theme of, you know, being able to do something on your own and almost kind of feeling like a failure if somehow you can't do that.
Right.
Well, so then you get on the med and it works. And what does that mean? How did it work?
I stopped wanting to not be alive, and I wanted to be alive. Mm-hmm. So that was good. I felt more like interacting. I wanted to read again.
Wow. Yeah.
Which, like I said, it was weird that it was so bad. I had never at any point since I had learned to read, not wanted to read. So sadly, that was one of the main things, was when I didn't want to read, it was like, oh, this is serious. I should probably go to the doctor.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wanted to read, and I just felt like I thought I was going to feel after that magic 6 month mark that I had made up in my head. I mean, I still don't know where that came from. And I don't know. I felt like me.
Yeah.
Which is not particularly descriptive, but I just felt like, oh, I'm back. Oh, and I like me, because I hadn't liked myself, loved myself, felt any kind of positive emotion towards myself in almost a year.
Right.
And And I was like, oh yeah, I like this one. I like this stuff.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.